Lauren Groff is from Cooperstown, New York, and she graduated from Amherst College in 2001 as a French and English double major. She then went on to earn her MFA in fiction from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's written 3 novels and 2 short story collections. Her most recent short story collection, called Florida, came out in June, and it's that collection that she and I will be talking about today. So, hi, Lauren. Thank you for...
Hi, Lauren.
super excited to talk to you. So I guess we can really just dive right in. I was thinking about, you know, in the opening story, Ghosts and Empties, the narrator has a moment where, you know, she's recently moved to Florida, and she says, you know, I decided that if I had to live in the South with its boiled peanuts and its Spanish moss dangling like armpit hair, at least I wouldn't barricade myself with my whiteness in a gated community, end quote. And I was curious to know sort of if that was something that you thought about before moving to Florida. I think race is so strange down there, being, you know, as someone who's from Florida. I'm just curious to know if maybe where that thought came from.
Yeah, so I was not necessarily prepared for a lot of the segregation that happens in Gainesville, because Gainesville, Florida, where I live, is an incredibly progressive city. In fact, I think we might be the most progressive city in Florida, which is saying a lot. But at the same time, there are these really weird stratified, like, divisions in the town. And so I came here, you know, and a lot of the book is talking about exploding my own preconceived notions of what Florida is. But I came here and we stayed for about a month in my parents-in-law's house. They sort of live on a swamp that they call a lake, and it has alligators and everything in it. And I was like, you know, I've been here in this weird gated community for... 2 months now, and I haven't seen a single African-American person, but I know that they live in Gainesville. What's going on? And I started to realize it's because this town is almost like multiple cities sort of living uncomfortably together. So my husband and I, when we went to buy a house, tried very hard to live in a place that was much more urban. It has people of all different races, of all different ethnicities, of all different socioeconomic levels. In fact, in the house that we moved into, and this actually comes out in that story, which is not autobiographical, there was a homeless person living under our house when we moved in. And we didn't know what to do because it was their home before it was ours. So we just sort of let it happen for a while until they went away. So we tried really hard to find a place in Gainesville that seems to be the nexus of all the different Gainesvilles that exist. And as you come from Florida, you know, right? This, it's just a very strange monkey bread state, and these things happen all over the place.
Yeah, it's it was interesting sort of, you know, leaving Florida, going to Amherst, seeing how diverse it was, you know, racially, socioeconomically, and then going back home during the holidays, because where I'm from is predominantly white, super religious, very conservative. And so it was sort of the first time that I started to realize how, I guess, different and unique of a place Florida is. So I thought it was cool that you addressed that sort of in that first story. But I'm curious, so you said that when you and your husband first moved into your place, there was, in fact, a homeless person living under your house. Did you have a relationship with them at all?
Yeah, it was an interesting. not really. So like we were so, I guess this is our first house that we ever bought. We'd only lived in rentals and apartments before, and we didn't want to be the nasty people who buy a house and suddenly like knock on the neighbor's doors if they're playing music past midnight. You know, like we wanted to be good neighbors, and we didn't know how to act. So, and also, I mean, this person was actually really very sensitive to us too, and so they would leave really early in the morning and come really late at night. So it was this weird symbiotic relationship without really interaction. I think they thought that we didn't know. I don't know. It was all very complex. So I could have done better.
No, that's quite a story. So I guess I wonder, this is probably a good segue into another question I have. I know that you've said in other interviews that, you know, the unnamed writer who narrates many of the stories throughout the collection is not you. And I'm curious to know if you could maybe talk a little bit about what connects you to those writers, or, you know, maybe what makes you similar to them, what makes you different.
So one of the things that I realized when I published my first book, which was in the first person, so, you know, there's that. It's called The Monsters of Templeton, and there are multiple, there are many, many points of view in that book. It's kind of a crazy book. It's definitely like, it was my fourth book I'd ever written, and I thought I was, like, never going to publish anything, so why not just do it, make it as crazy as you possibly can. And when I went out on book tour with that book, I hadn't taken into consideration that there's this hysterical pregnancy in the book. And I was pregnant at the time I was on tour. And I swear to God, not only one person, but two people actually stood up in a Q&A session, looked at my giant belly and asked me if I were truly pregnant. So there's this feeling where, there's a certain sort of almost biographical fallacy that plays into readers' minds, especially when the writer is a relatively young woman, as I was at the time. So from that moment, I did realize that no matter what I was going to write, people are going to seek to see me in it, right? And I also think that that's one of the temptations of reading living writers, is to see the life in the work. So I've been playing with that since that day, and it really is a lot of play. I sort of see it as a dance that you make with the reader. You know, you and I are going out and we're having a tango, and I'll spin you out and then I'll pull you back in, you know, like a top. And so there are a lot of stories that seem to be from the perspective of the same woman, right? She has two sons. In one story, she's a writer, and the other one, it's not really clear what she is. And to be perfectly honest, she's not me, but someone from the inside of my life, like my husband or my children, would look at her and say, she's absolutely not me. So what I'm doing in those situations is sort of playing with the expectation of biographical fallacy. And I'm bringing the reader in tight, in the dance that we're dancing together.
So I guess I also wonder, so in the last story, and I guess that's the one where I hadn't realized it wasn't very clear whether so this is the one where, you know, a mother take her two sons to France, and she wants to go to France in particular because she's aiming to write about an author, and she wants to visit the places where he grew up and where he visited. And so I guess I did assume that she was a writer, but maybe this is the one where you said it's not necessarily clear, you know, what she does. But there was one point where, you know, she says the default voice in stories is male. And I sort of paused and was thinking about how in your collection, the default voice is female. And there were some times as I was reading where it was very clear that the female character was trying to shirk off traditional gender roles. But you sort of complicated it because sometimes, you know, they were shirking off these roles, but maybe to the point of hurting themselves or coming off as indifferent. And I was curious to know sort of how much you were meditating on how these female voices came across throughout the collection.
Actively. And Lola, I have to say, at this point, I've given probably 200 interviews, and this is the first time anyone's ever asked this. And I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. for educating people to ask beautiful questions like this. I was very deeply invested in the sort of reconsidering expectations, gender expectations, and what it is that we just default to when we're not only talking about mother or parenthood, right? Because this is something that I chafe against every single day of my life as a parent. But also about the voice of female creators. And it's something that's in my day-to-day perception of the world and how we just fall into these automatic positions of bias unless we're constantly questioning what it is that we think and what it is that we feel. Even the people who have the best intentions in the world fall into these biased ideas. And it's because we live in a society, right? Like, that's what the societies give us, a whole network of subterranean rules by which we all elect to play. But some of these rules are sort of predicated on historical eras that are not contemporaneous and do not actually speak to who we are as people now. And so pushing up against them, I find, is the job of not only a creative person, of an artist, but it's also the job of someone who likes to think a lot. And it's the job of someone, honestly, who got a liberal arts education because, yeah, it didn't teach us to program computers, right? Or to, you know, shoot rockets in the air, but it did teach us to question the principles by which civilization has always gone forward and to see if we can actually undermine some of the more painful and hurtful ones. I was really invested in these questions in the book. Also, what makes a good man, right? Because the person in these stories is raising two sons in today's really terrible world of toxic masculinity. And so that's another question that goes into this book, and it goes into sort of the anxiety is sort of attendant and underneath the surface of each of these stories in the book.
Yeah, that sort of that point where you said, you know, also asking the question of what makes a good man, I was immediately reminded of the, I think it was at the Round Earth's Imagine Corners, sort of the one where the dad is very, I guess, adventurous and is collecting snakes and interacting a lot with reptiles. And it's interesting to see how, I guess, he raises his son and his relationship to his father. And I was curious, especially because this in some ways is related to Amherst. You were saying that, you know, you have a liberal arts education and you're taught to question and to think differently and outside of the box. But at the same time, it's pretty easy or common, I think, for people to, at least from what I've noticed, sort of have these questions, but maybe still go down traditional routes. And there's a line in both At the Round Earth's Imagined Corners and in Above and Below, where the main characters are sort of meditating on whether they took enough risks. There's, you know, the line where, was it in Above and Below, the narrator says, but she'd been too careful in the end, unable to take the necessary scholarly risk, and they had withdrawn even that from her. And I guess I'm curious, maybe what inspired you to, I guess, yeah, write those parts where you have throughout the collections people questioning the world they live in, but then also characters who are maybe not acting on the answers they receive from those questions?
Yeah, sometimes I wonder if the act of creating fiction in particular is the act of sort of trying to balance tensions, or maybe not tensions, but forces that are pushing us toward security and forces that are pushing us toward maybe chaos, or not chaos, but breaking up of security in some ways, right? It's the tension between the individual and the community. The individual wants freedom and the community longs for, you know, laws and rules and things to be in the right places at the right time. So that's one of the really inherent underlying, I guess, powers in any work of fiction is this idea between trying to push up against the invisible boundaries of convention. And I do think that when it comes to most people, if you're going to look at them as fictional characters, you do start to see in almost everyone, there's a moment where there's a faltering back into safety, right? Because that safety is one of those things. I think it's, I feel like it's probably a universal human need. And there's a certain point where you can't just be a risk taker 24 hours a day. You need to go home and go to bed, right? You need to conform and come back to the fold and renew yourself in order to go back out and sally forth. And so I think that in most of my stories, there's a point where my characters just get exhausted and they have to stop and they have to recoup. And I think that's, you know, from my observations of humanity, I see it all the time and I see it in myself on a daily basis. So this is, you know, you just play with what you have.
I see. And then that actually, I wasn't planning on asking you this question, but now I'm thinking about it. When you were talking about you just mentioned your observations of humanity. And something that I really loved about this collection was how precise your language was and just sort of how descriptive of parts, where your characters were, of the environment that I hadn't even thought of existing. And I guess I wonder, can you maybe talk a little bit about maybe how your observations turned into these incredibly rich sentences and phrases.
Thanks. So I actually think that that's one of the jobs of a writer or of someone who's creative is to see things that are familiar and to make them strange again. I mean, if you look at anything for long enough, it'll start to seem alien. I know you probably did this too, because I also think this is probably a universal thing. But when you're a kid, you probably took a word, any word, maybe even your own name,
yeah,
and said it. Oh, until you were alienated from that word, and it became sort of spiky and bizarre and sort of rich and strange to you. But I think that there's strangeness lurking under familiarity everywhere you go. And when I was at Amherst, actually, for the first 2 years, I thought of myself as a poet, even though it was just really evident from the world telling me that I'm not a poet. But I did take from my early studies of poetry and not only the creation of poetry, but also sort of the understanding of scansion and poetic form, a lot of the ideas about attention to the singular thing until it becomes strange, and then you can describe it. Because that, for me, I don't know, you know, we all, when we write, we try to fill our work with the things that feed us the most. And language is the thing that makes me get up in the morning. Other than my children, language is the thing that makes me get up. So it's, If I'm having a bad day, I will pull George Eliot off the shelf and I will sit in her beautiful, lucid, limpid language and feel better. You know, because communication means different things to different people, but for me, it is a way of not only, it's again, right, the tension between security and obliteration. And for me, it's being wrapped in security and at the same time seeing my normal gray wool life, and seeing sort of pulling it apart and seeing sort of the wonder underneath that. And language can do that the most easily for me.
I guess to sort of go to the destruction side and the obliterations part of the tension, throughout the stories, there's overwhelming heat, there are a lot of storms. In Eyewall, a woman is inside while a storm is wreaking havoc on her home. Salvador, a woman is trapped in a store with a predatory grocer. She's trapped because there is this crazy storm outside. And I'm curious to know whether living in Florida has sort of changed your views on climate change, or maybe even your relationship to climate change, the way you think about it.
Yeah, well, so I've been here for 12 years. I think 12 years ago, even those of us who are the most perceptive about climate change would never have seen where we would be now, right? I mean, I think that was always the fear, but now it's just the reality. So the thing about living in Florida, as you well know, is that no matter how you try, you can't really keep nature out. It just comes comes inside with you with these gusts of humidity as you open the door. I have this, it sounds really gross, but I live in Florida, so you'll get it. There's this lizard that lives inside one of the air conditioning vents in my house. And I wouldn't ever want him to go outside because I kind of love him. But at this point, he's been here for so many years. It's some sort of, like, just, I don't know why he's been here for so long. But he's kind of bleached. He's kind of a bleached lizard. And he only comes out at night. And, you know, I wait for him sometimes. And he reminds me that no matter how domesticated I believe I am, there's just this wildness lurking underneath. So, to get back to your point, though, I do go outside every day on a run, and I try to run every single day just for mental health reasons. And I go out to this beautiful place called Payne's Prairie, and there's actually in the middle of Florida a giant prairie. And I have been able to track with my own eyes sort of the rapidity of climate change here in Florida, and it is so astonishing and frightening. I mean, you know, Miami is not going to be around in 20 years if we don't do something. The aquifer is going to get salinated, and we won't have fresh water. So, I mean, Florida really is one of the most vulnerable states. It's also one of the richest states when it comes to the environment and botany and lizards. I mean, I want to save lizards. So is it my perception from being here has been a perception of the absolute vulnerability of the world and the rapidity of what is happening to it through human greed. Yeah, it's bad.
It really is.
Very bad.
And I like that you actually just said vulnerable, because I don't know. I'm not often shocked while reading. I don't know if that means I'm not reading the right books. It likely does. And it's same with TV shows, although Westworld is pretty shocking. But I guess there were so many surprises and unexpected turns throughout your stories. I'm forgetting actually the name, but Salvador, when, you know, the woman is trapped in the store with the grocer. I was just sort of, I thought I knew it was going to happen. And then, you know, he put his hand on her thigh, and I thought, oh no, this is about to be assault. And then, that is assault. I thought it was going to go even further. And it didn't, and then it changed in a different way, and it just happened so many times throughout the stories. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, as you wrote, was it a goal to shock your readers, or how much were you thinking about all of these twists and turns and surprises?
The funny thing is, when I write a story, I never think about the reader at all until the end. And then I start to think about the reader. So I do think that literary fiction in the latter part of the 20th century in particular, or actually in all of the 20th century, has sort of backed away from the idea of events plot as being a good quality. But plot is how you seduce a reader who doesn't want to read your work into continuing to read it. So you know, I do think of fiction as a seduction, right? And eventually you're going to carry the reader along with your, whatever the attributes are that you value. And I think that plot has been scorned for far too long, and I think that it's important and interesting. It's because plot happens in our lives. In as much as I love, like, the Virginia Woolf interiority, I also think that happens in our lives, but also crazy things, like, jump out at you, and storms happen more and more often these days, and people disappoint you, and things happen in life. Life isn't all about the sad thoughts of someone standing on the edge of a cliff, which is what literary fiction has been for so long. So I think that, you know, seizing backplot is, in some ways I see it, and this is probably ridiculous, but in some ways I see it as almost a democratic move, move away from academia as sort of the foundation of what we want in our fiction, and a way to engage people who don't think that they really want to read your work and try to make them read your work. Yeah. And see other humans as other people who are different from you as worthy of attention and worthy of love and worthy of the human kindness that one gets from reading about people who are different from you. I think that that's really, really important.
I'm wondering, is there anything I didn't ask you about Florida that you want to talk about in this interview?
You're so good. No, you're so good at what you do. I'm so, you know, like, I don't even know you, but you're a young Amherst alum, and I'm proud of you. It's so great.
Oh, thank you. And I'm proud of you, too. I don't know how much that means coming from a 23-year-old, but no, this is great. I'm so excited to have this connection with you.
Millennials are the best. You're going to save us. Please save us.